La pace sia con tutti voi.
1 month into the papacy of Pope Leo XIV, we analyze some of his pontificate's emerging themes with a leading thought leader on the subject of faith, columnist Ross Delpit from the New York Times.
Walking with Jesus across the country really is something I didn't want to miss.
A unique look at the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage with our own Father Joseph Mary Wolf of the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word as he joins the pilgrimage through his home archdiocese in America's heartland. And we go to Rome for the Jubilee of Families, Children, Grandparents, and the Elderly. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Non rimandare.
Do not procrastinate. Roll up your sleeves, because the Lord is generous and will not disappoint you. Working in his vineyard, you will find the answer to that profound question you carry within you. What is the meaning of my life?
1 month ago, Pope Leo XIV ascended to the throne of St. Peter, becoming the 267th pope in world history and the first one to be born in the United States. As he advised those who came to his general audience this week, he himself is rolling up his sleeves and getting straight to the many challenges facing the Catholic Church, the faithful, and the world at large. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Throughout the past 4 weeks, all eyes have been on Pope Leo, eager to see what priorities will guide his pontificate. From the moment he greeted the world from St. Peter's Square on May 8th, one mission of the Holy Father's is clear: build bridges and restore unity, both in his divided flock and in a globe torn apart by conflict.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
In his first words to the world, he spoke of peace. On the loggia overlooking St. Peter's Square shortly after his election, Pope Leo XIV gave the world a glimpse at one of his key priorities as pontiff: unity.
We must seek together how to be a missionary church, a church that builds bridges, dialogue, always open to welcome, like this square with open arms, all those who need our presence.
Even the vestments he wore on the loggia reflected this desire for unity. Jonathan Liddle, a senior editor at the National Catholic Register, says his decision to wear the traditional red mozzetta and stole, unlike Pope Francis in 2013, suggests a nod to other popes that came before him.
That was a signal that Pope Leo was sending. He was very aware of the connotations. He chose to wear that, and many people interpret it as an emphasis on continuity.
Throughout his speeches and homilies, Pope Leo has frequently quoted writings from previous pontiffs.
So we're seeing what appears to be a sort of very intentional synthesis or blend of not just Francis or not just John Paul II and Benedict XVI, but all of the popes who came before Pope Leo. It's very likely that some of these little hat tips were actually made very intentionally to reach out to different groups within the church and get them on board.
Leo's celebrations of the liturgy, including his use of chant, has encouraged Catholics who prefer traditional liturgies that the Holy Father might not restrict the traditional Latin Mass as his predecessor had.
When he celebrates the Mass, people see this emphasis, this intentionality in his gestures, in his words, in the way he speaks, that I think has given a lot of hope to people maybe who belong to some of those traditionalist communities.
Along with these efforts to build bridges within the church, Pope Leo has worked to unite a world fragmented by conflict. At an audience with the heads of the Eastern churches, Pope Leo promised to make every effort for lasting peace in their war-torn nations. He has especially made efforts to facilitate peace between Ukraine and Russia, expressing his closeness with the Ukrainian people during his first Regina Celi address.
May everything possible be done to reach an authentic, just, and lasting peace as soon as possible. Let all the prisoners be freed and the children return to their own families.
Just a few days into his pontificate, Pope Leo held a phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, later hosting him for a private audience. And this week, the Vatican confirmed the Holy Father spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday about the conflict. It's the first publicly known phone call Putin has had with a pontiff since launching his full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 3 years ago. In late May, Pope Leo even reportedly offered to host direct peace talks at the Vatican, though the Kremlin rejected this proposal. Navigating these divides, both in the church and in the world, will come with its challenges.
Maintaining the balance as he sort of welcomes one group without alienating another is going to be, I think, a unique challenge precisely because of how divided the church is right now on some really central questions.
But his background as the former prior general of the Order of St. Augustine for more than a decade might make him uniquely suited for the job. The Augustinian life is deeply rooted in community and friendship. Quoting his order's namesake, he chose the episcopal motto, "In the one Christ, we are one," a reflection of the charism and leadership that will guide his pontificate.
But I think what we also see from Pope Leo is a long experience of living out communion and friendship as an Augustinian that'll probably have significant implications in how he leads the church going forward.
The recent election of Pope Leo XIV has sparked new interest in Catholicism, with Google data showing a spike in users searching how to become Catholic shortly after the death of Pope Francis in April. But religion data analyst Dr. Ryan Burge says it's too early to see national trends on the Pope Leo effect or a revival of Catholicism in America.
If you look at the macro level trends, there's really no evidence that people are starting to identify as Catholic in much higher numbers. You might hear a pocket there, or a pocket here, but you know, the plural of anecdote is not data. When we're talking about 62 million Catholics in America, it would take a lot of people actually coming to the church for that to show up in a large, national level survey.
To discuss the current state of faith and Pope Leo XIV's first month at the helm of the Catholic Church, we are joined by a leading Catholic voice in American journalism today. Ross Douthat is an opinion columnist for The New York Times, where he often reflects on the intersection of faith, culture, and public life. A prolific writer, Douthat is also author of the new book, Believe, Why Everyone Should Be Religious. In it, he offers a blueprint for how someone can think their way from doubt of faith into belief. Ross, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I want to start off now with a big picture look at our religious landscape right now. According to Pew Research Center, 62% of U.S. adults identify as Christian. That's a 9% drop from 2014. And meanwhile, 29% of U.S. adults are not affiliated with any religion today, a 6% increase from 2014, though it does seem that decline of Christianity has somewhat plateaued in recent years. But tell us about why you think we're seeing these trends, and what do you hope your book addresses in this moment?
I think what you already mentioned it, right, that we are in this kind of interesting plateau after a long period of institutional religious decline and secularization. So if you go back to the turn of the 21st century, the year 2000, and run the clock forward, you get like 15 or 20 years where year in, year out, the number of people identifying as Christian declines, the number of people going to church, going to mass declines. And then around the time of the pandemic or thereafter, it was like it hit a kind of limit. Mm. And for the last 4 or 5 years, you've had a certain kind of stabilization. And what I like to say to people is, it's not that America is having a religious revival. It's more that we're considering whether to have a religious revival. So you have a surge of interest in religion, and some of that shows up in traditional faith. Some of it shows up in anything from UFOs to psychedelics. But it's a very unsettled but curious landscape. And the book I wrote is trying to be written, it's trying to work into that landscape, to basically say to a lot of people who were raised without religion, mm-hmm. like, we're not dealing with lapsed Catholics mm-hmm. anymore, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we are, but mm-hmm. we're not, but we're dealing with a generation, many of whom have come of age with no connection to institutional faith at all. They're interested, they're curious, but it's like, well, what is this religion thing anyway, right?
Well, and I want to hit on, bring in some of that data that you hit on. There is this, yes, that trend and plateau of religiously unaffiliated, but many U.S. dioceses this year saw an increase in the number of converts. If you look at the Diocese of Cleveland, about a 50% growth in converts from last year.
Yep.
Diocese of Winona, Rochester, Minnesota, up 67%. Diocese of San Angelo in Texas, up about 56%. That's just to name a few. So you don't think there's necessarily a revival going on per se, but what do you think this speaks to?
Well, and you have numbers like that actually in Western Europe mm-hmm. as well. France has seen record numbers of adult baptisms. The United Kingdom, there's been data suggesting that Generation Z, the youngest generation, is more likely to be church-going than Generation X or the millennial generation at this point. But yeah, I think it speaks to that renewed interest and mm-hmm. that sense, I think, above all, that you know, certain promises were made about what a more secular world was supposed to look like. If you go back to the early 2000s and the heyday of the new atheists, figures like Richard Dawkins and so on, there was a sense that, well, of course, once we, you know, get rid of these hidebound Bronze Age superstitions, mm-hmm. everyone will get along better. Politics will be less polarized, science will be held in higher esteem, and sociologically people will be happier, kids won't be afraid of going to hell, things like that. And obviously none of that has happened, right? The country is more divided, more polarized, mm-hmm. and there's just more, frankly, existential angst that people have, again, not surprisingly, in the absence of a supernatural horizon. So you have a lot of people, some of whom are coming into the church, others who are sort of exploring around the edges, who are mm-hmm. reacting to that environment.
Ross, the day after Pope Leo was elected, you wrote in the New York Times about the cultural state that we're in right now, the church that he has inherited. And you wrote in part, this is a much weirder landscape than the one in which liberal and conservative Catholics clash over contraception or gay marriage. And it's likely to get weirder still as we move deeper into a digital and virtual and artificial intelligence-mediated existence. Can you expand on that? What is this weird landscape that Pope Leo now has to navigate?
Well, he's already said, right, that, you know, one reason he took the name Leo was because Leo XIII, the last pope with that name, was pope at a time of huge industrial and technological transformation and sort of offered a distinctively Catholic witness for that age. And the Holy Father has said, you know, we're in a similar moment potentially with artificial intelligence and digital life. And the church has to figure out what it wants to say about those set of issues. So it's not that the older culture war issues have gone away. It's not that, you know, abortion doesn't matter or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But there is this landscape mm-hmm. that people live in, mm-hmm. Online, disconnected or connected in new ways, right, mm-hmm. that is, I think, clearly perilous to the soul in various ways. It has deep effects on family and marriage and community, where you're trying to figure out how to raise kids in this environment. And there are fundamental questions of morality and spirituality that mm-hmm. are bound up in how you relate to your phone. And I think it is really important for the church to figure out what to say about it. Like right now, you know, there's no bigger obstacle to people having kids and having families, some people think, than digital life, right? So it's not, you know, Humana Vitae in the 60s is writing about contraception as an impediment to mm-hmm. Christian marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying we're getting an encyclical about the iPhone as an impediment to Christian marriage, but, like, that is the kind of weird, that's one weird zone. The other weird zone is that there's just more interest in the supernatural and again, this sort of is operating outside often of traditional religious paradigms. It's people into UFOs. It's people into all kinds of do-it-yourself spirituality. And there, too, the church is kind of used to talking to a secular audience mm-hmm. and saying, oh, you know, come on, you know, God right. really exists and mm-hmm. so on. Now it's often talking to people who are like, oh, I believe in a spirit world, people who have sort of re-paganized in mm-hmm. some ways without returning to Christianity, and that is itself a different challenge.
You were in Rome recently for the inaugural Mass of Pope Leo XIV. As we mark the first month of his pontificate, what have been your first impressions of Pope Leo so far?
I mean, first of all, just to get elected pope without having anyone outside the world of intense Catholic media, and even some people within that world, mm-hmm. have any kind of clear and definite impression of him, suggests a really interesting kind of dark horse sort of figure who's very good at making different groups of people feel heard and understood, and very good, hopefully, at promoting a certain kind of unity.
It's been 4 years now since Pope Francis released his papal document, Traditionis Custodes, which imposed severe restrictions on the celebration of the Mass in Latin. Some might argue that these restrictions, which were intended for unity, in fact brought about greater division. What action do you think Pope Leo...
some would argue that, yes.
And you might argue that as well. What action does Pope Leo need to take, in your opinion, on Traditionis Custodes, and how much should he prioritize this early on?
I think that there is an argument that because, in fact, that document was not received in the same way in every diocese, that there were lots and lots of bishops and archbishops who thought that it would lead to more division if they cracked down on the Latin Mass in various ways, that means that, in a sense, the Pope could just sort of leave things alone a bit and basically say, all right, you know, we issued this document, or my predecessor issued this document, but really it's up to the local church, and Rome is just not going to put pressure on people to enforce it, which seemed to be quite often what was happening. I would not expect to see a formal rollback of the document. I think the more likely expectation is a kind of hands-off approach with some targeted moves to tell bishops that, in fact, the Vatican is not enthused about further crackdowns. That would be my guess, but I'm just speculating.
The day after Pope Leo's inaugural Mass, you sat down with U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance in Rome for your podcast, Interesting Times, and it was right after Vance met privately with Pope Leo, and the discussion hit on this tension that exists between Trump administration policy and what the Vatican thinks, especially relevant because Vance himself is a convert to Catholicism. And I want to play just part of your exchange with Vance for our viewers.
I'm not going to pretend that I haven't struggled with some of this, that I haven't thought about whether, you know, we're doing the precisely right thing. So it's a fair point, and I know that you think you've got me trapped here.
I don't think I have
no,
you.
No, I'm not.
All right, let me be perfectly honest. I'm not interested in having you trapped here. We're having a conversation in Rome as a journalist and a vice president, but also as two Catholics,
I think it's, to be clear, I think it's a totally fair question.
I'm interested in what politics does to people, soul.
Ross, based on your interview with Vice President Vance, what did you make of how Vance sees his role as a Catholic U.S. vice president who has to be mindful of the Vatican's opinions?
I mean, I think it's a tremendous challenge, right? Especially because he's vice president. He's not president, right? So there's always a certain kind of tension between, again, being an elected politician in a pluralist non-Catholic society and trying to be faithful to the teachings of the church. And that, again, has showed up most sharply for Democratic politicians in debates about abortion, but it has showed up for politicians of both parties in many cases over the years. When you're vice president, though, you aren't fully in control of your own agenda. I was pressing him because I think there is some real tensions here, especially in things the Trump administration has done in terms of sending people to the somewhat famous prison in El Salvador and so on, where I think a Vatican critique of the White House would carry some weight, and the vice president, you know, in this weird dual role, has to wrestle with that.
And finally, Ross, here we are marking the first month of Pope Leo's pontificate. So if you had to look so far, what are the three words you would use to describe Pope Leo the 14th?
I would describe him as, so far, unifying, charming, and I'm going to append a adjective, so it'll be four words, but mildly inscrutable, which I think is also has been sort of part of the reason he was elected Pope in the first place. There is still a hint of mystery to who the Pope definitively is and what he definitively thinks. And there may be a long period of time where that mystery gradually unfolds in the life of the church.
Well, we're grateful for your voice along the way. Ross Douthat, the author of Believe Why Everyone Should Be Religious.
Everyone.
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 Everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to hear additional elements of my discussion with Ross, go to the EWTN YouTube page for an extended version of this conversation. There is much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Next, we go to the heartland of America to join the trail of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage.
The 2025 National Eucharistic Pilgrimage Drexel Route passes through Missouri and Kansas, with a stop at this downtown Kansas City parish, founded 115 years ago for African-American Catholics by St. Catherine Drexel herself. That story and more about the ongoing National Eucharistic Pilgrimage ahead.
We had a lot of people that were watching as we walked with our Lord and prayed and sang.
EWTN News in Depth continues on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage Trail, this time in Missouri and Kansas, as pilgrims bear witness to the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Through 10 states and along more than 3,000 miles, pilgrims are traveling the St. Catherine Drexel route. The pilgrimage is raising awareness of the U.S. Bishop's ongoing Eucharistic revival in its third year now. It's the year of mission of going out and spreading devotion to the Eucharist. From Indianapolis to Los Angeles in mid-June, the four-week Drexel route winds through both city and country locations. A group of eight perpetual pilgrims is traveling the entire route, accompanied by Catholic chaplains. Along the way, everyone is invited to join for a day or two at any place that they can. Reporter Alan Holdren caught up with the perpetual pilgrims and other faithful Catholics along the route in the very heart of our nation in Missouri and Kansas.
The scene as our Lord is taken in procession to St. Monica of Africa Catholic Church, a predominantly African-American parish in Kansas City, Missouri, on May the 27th. A historic stage for the Eucharistic pilgrims on the Drexel route. St. Catherine Drexel herself worked with Kansas City's bishop to start a church and school here in 1910. The original single building housed both and still stands as a testament to her investment in this community. Current church was built on the same campus in 1961 and renovated in 2001.
She basically helped buy this land, but also helped build the first church and the first school, which happened to be this building.
She was very rich, and she could have done anything with her money, but she sought it to look to those who had less than and to reach out and help us get started.
We're proud to be a part of that heritage that was left by Santa Catherine Drexel. The purpose to certainly give thanks for what she did back over 100 years ago, but at the same time, the kind of what she was all about, the mission that she had, the love that she had, and we try to spread that.
There's adoration, a reflection on the life of St. Catherine Drexel, and the music that makes this parish famous locally. The Drexel connection also leaves its mark on the Eucharistic pilgrims, traveling the length of the route.
Just to see that connection between our roots patron saint and the history of this community was really beautiful. And to see also just the devotion and beauty expressed in how the community was worshiping in their praise and worship music, but all directed to the same Eucharistic Lord that we've been walking with for the past 10 days.
After a brief but intense visit, the perpetual pilgrims get on the road again for a new state the next day. Kansas.
Here in Wichita, there's a thriving Catholic community. There are full 50 Eucharistic Adoration chapels across the diocese, and most of those offer perpetual adoration. That's 24 hours a day. It's an important part of Catholic life here.
At Wichita's Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception, many families turn out on a Wednesday morning as the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage events begin. First, a votive Mass of the Holy Spirit, led by Wichita Bishop Carl Kemi, praying for a special intention.
For those souls that were lost in that terrible plane tragedy in Washington, D.C., a plane that originated from here in Wichita last January.
And then the solemn procession.
Hallelujah, King Eternal, you Jesus Christ and the Blessed Sacrament taken out into the streets, all the way to City Hall, where Bishop Kemi blesses Wichita from the steps. A first. After processing back into the cathedral, adoration, which is such a big part of the Catholic culture here, continues. The Eucharistic renewal has brought Catholics in Wichita ever deeper into the mystery that is already at the center of their lives.
That has a profound effect in our Catholic life here, our Mass attendance, our vocations, our marriages, our family life. It's all rooted, I think, in our Lord and the Blessed Sacrament.
All throughout the day, people stop in, at peace, but energized by the day's events and enlivened by an encounter with Christ, the purpose of the 3-year Eucharistic renewal in the United States.
It's shown me that there are other people out there who have such love and respect for God and for His church and for the Eucharist.
To see a procession like this, to have the Eucharist out in the open, not confined to the church, wow, what an amazing thing to be a part of.
We're seeing in our country today a lot of people that are starting to remember He's here, He's present, He's drawing me closer, and we're all being invited, and I'm hoping that this will be just one other step to draw people closer to Him.
Later, the Eucharistic pilgrims volunteer at the Lord's Diner, a soup kitchen founded by a former bishop of Wichita, connecting them again to their patroness.
I think this is like a huge part of this route in particular is like the service aspect of it. And that was like a huge part of St. Catherine Drexel's mission. It was part of her way of life. I think there's like a natural compulsion when you receive the Eucharist to like go out, to share the gospel, to live as Jesus lived, to be one and like united with like Christ's mission here on earth.
As Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament makes his way across the U.S. on pilgrimage, opportunities for adoration, processions, and shared experiences abound as the perpetual pilgrims, just like St. Catherine Drexel before them, bring Christ to the people where they are. In Kansas City, Missouri, and Wichita, Kansas, Alan Holdren, EWTN News in Depth.
We have more highlights from the St. Catherine Drexel route next when we are joined here in studio by a very special guest, a familiar face who will share his unique witness of the strength of our Catholic faith during his visit to the farmland of Iowa.
We have such a deep Catholic heritage, such beautiful churches out here, and we thought we're a rural archdiocese, and so we really wanted to highlight the importance of rural, Catholic rural life in the archdiocese.
A pastor of a group of Iowa churches along the Mississippi River talks about deep spirituality in the heartland as the real presence of Christ travels by boat up the river and then processes onto the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage for miles on foot through the freshly planted farm fields of Iowa. Now, something special and unique to EWTN. For the last year, EWTN News in Depth has been reporting on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimages. In 2024, we provided exclusive coverage of the four pilgrimages that came from the four corners of the U.S. to the National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis in July. Now, in 2025, the last pilgrimage of the 3-year Eucharistic revival, the St. Catherine Drexel route. But never before have we heard from one of our own EWTN friars, a Franciscan missionary of the Eternal Word who himself has taken part in one of these pilgrimages. Viewers of EWTN know Father Joseph Mary Wolfe. He has been with the network for 40 years. He recently took the opportunity to join the St. Catherine Drexel route as it wound its way through the Archdiocese of Dubuque, Iowa, which just so happens to be where Father Joseph grew up on a family farm. Several of his relatives still live and farm in the area. While traveling along with the Blessed Sacrament, he came away with his own pilgrimage experience as he participated in processions, adoration, celebrated Mass, and conducted interviews for the friar's own programming. At Iowa State University, he asked several active young Catholics what their advice is for other young people inspired by the pilgrimage to grow in their faith.
to quote Blessed Carlo, paraphrasing here, but the more time you spend out in the sun, you get tan, but spending time in front of our Lord, especially in the Eucharist, you become saints.
Educating yourself on what it means to be Catholic and what the Catholic faith entails and the responsibility you have as a Catholic is an amazing way of growing deeper.
Plan it intentionally and guard it jealously. Like, don't let anything come in the way of your 15 minutes of prayer, regardless of when it's at in the day.
And we are delighted now to be joined in studio by Father Joseph to share more of his experience along the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Father, it's so good to have you here in D.C. Mm-hmm. Thank you for traveling here after you traveled to Iowa.
Yes.
So tell us about your travels on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. What stood out to you?
It was really a highlight of my priesthood, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to go back to where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, the Archbishop of Dubuque was himself a farm boy from that. And I had a short interview with him as well. We talked about, you know, at the core of our being, we're still farm boys. And that's how we describe ourselves as Iowa farm boys. Mm. But to be there, when I saw that the Eucharistic Pilgrimage was going to be passing through that archdiocese, I said, I have to go. You know, I have to be part of this. And really, it was wonderful to meet some of the young clergy. I've been with EWTN for 40 years, mm-hmm. so I haven't gotten to know well a lot of the Iowa clergy, but just some remarkable young priests and zealous young people as well.
And to process through the farm fields.
That's right.
With our Lord. Mm-hmm. In the Archdiocese of Dubuque, the pilgrimage included, as we said, a visit mm-hmm. to the Iowa State University's Catholic Center. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about what you encountered there.
And that's an interesting connection, too. I was actually there last year for my nephew's daughter's baptism.
Oh, wow.
That's the parish that he belongs to, mm-hmm. and that affected his own life. Mm-hmm. He wanted to remain a member of that parish because it's really a parish that's on fire. Mm-hmm. And you saw Father Joseph Sivchik there at the beginning. He was studying at Iowa State, bioengineering and some other things. But because of that Catholic center, his own vocation sprang from that. He told me that many vocations to the Archdiocese of Dubuque come from that Catholic center because they have a wonderful center where they can get together and have small groups, where they have Adoration of the Blessed Sacrament, and just some young people really on fire with the faith.
That's so encouraging. And Father, mm-hmm. as we've been talking about, you yourself, you are from Iowa. Mm-hmm. Even over 20 years ago, you actually hosted a series for EWTN called Faith in the Heartland.
Yes.
And I know that that region to our country is obviously very dear to you, but for many mm-hmm. Americans, maybe some viewers, Iowa is considered flyover country.
That's right.
But Father, based on your experiences, what do you think we all can learn from the Catholic faithful who are living in the heartland of America?
You know, I was so encouraged by just the history of that area. Mm-hmm. It's a very strong Catholic culture there I grew up in. And part of that is because of the missionaries who came there. Mm-hmm. These zealous men, like Venerable Samuel Mazzucchelli, mm-hmm. he was this Dominican friar who at the age, I think, of 22, came to the New World to be a missionary. And when he was ordained here in Cincinnati, the bishop sends him out 500 miles away. You know, he founds these churches along the Mississippi River Valley. Mm-hmm. One of those was St. Raphael's in Dubuque, Iowa, which eventually became the cathedral. And then Bishop Loris was the first bishop. Well, when he was appointed there, this was known as the Northwest Territory. It included Iowa, Minnesota, North, South Dakota, and Montana. So it's like this huge area. And he has no clergy to do it with. Hmm. So he goes to France. He brings back two priests and four subdeacons. That's what he has to work with, this vast territory. But he's also a friend of John V. Annie. And they stayed in touch throughout that. But it was a lot of their zeal that built this Catholic culture there.
And I do feel like the pilgrimage does allow us to learn more about our American mm-hmm. Catholic history.
Right.
Father, can you speak more? You said this was a highlight of your priesthood.
Yes.
On a personal note, can you share more of what this journey meant to you?
Yeah, I think just, again, learning more about the history of this whole area and just the zeal of those missionaries, I really grew an appreciation of my background. Mm. You know, I had Franciscan sisters who taught me in grade school, and it was just kind of the environment where you learned virtue by working hard on the farm, by living in communities where everybody knows everybody, and you have a care for each other. So there's a real security you had because where you attended church, the spire was the only thing standing, you know, higher than anything else in that little towns that we had. But you knew everybody in that parish, and you felt like you'd always rely on each other. When my own grandfather, my mother's father, was killed tragically in a car accident, well, the harvest hadn't been brought in yet. So the local farmers all got together to bring in the harvest to help her. So that was the kind of attitude that people had.
Community becomes all the more vital.
Right.
It sounds like, you know, as we said, the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, it will conclude this month on the Solemnity of Corpus Christi in Los Angeles. It officially will mark the end of the three-year Eucharistic revival here in the United States. Father, what are your thoughts on how this initiative has gone and what fruit do you anticipate we might see come from it?
I've been excited to see at EWTN, too, more young people coming to confession, coming to adoration, because we have adoration 7 days a week there at EWTN. But I think this is one of the things that I'm seeing, that young people are coming to discover this, and older people, too, are coming to discover that the Lord remains with us in this profound way in the Blessed Sacrament, and that we can really grow in an intimacy, a friendship with Him, by spending time with Him in the Blessed Sacrament. You know, the friars, we have this thing we called outside the friary. So these are little pieces that we put together of when we're going outside the friary, we're meeting different people. So this coming Wednesday, the friars are going to be posting. It's also going to be on EWTN's Facebook, but the friars' social media as well, a whole compilation of what I experienced, some of the interviews I did, and people get a bigger taste of it, I guess.
Oh, yeah. That's excellent. I can't wait to see that. You know, the pilgrimage you walked is named after St. Catherine Drexel, a U.S.-born saint. And it does seem, and we've kind of hit on this already, but this Eucharistic pilgrimage, it kind of equips the faithful to learn more about the roots of American Catholicism. I know I traveled on the St. Elizabeth Ann Seton route last year. I realized I knew nothing about her. Had you learned more about St. Catherine Drexel? Or, again, it sounds like you learned a lot more about our American Catholic
roots.
What a
story. I mean, that she inherits this huge fortune. And how is she going to use it? To just enhance her own life? Of course not. She uses it to help the Native American and African American people. And, you know, I met this sister. We actually have this beautiful Dominican contemplative community in Marbury, Alabama. One of those sisters knew Catherine Drexel. She was in Nashville at one of their schools, and she said Catherine Drexel would come once a year and she'd look over their work. She wanted to be a nun, but she wanted to be a contemplative. And in Alabama, they started this integrated community in Marbury, which she joined at a very young age. She's now in her 90s, a beautiful soul. But that's one of the souls that Catherine Drexel touched through her work.
And Father, while we have you, you obviously knew EWTN foundress Mother Angelica very well. What did our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament mean to her?
Well, she was a poor Claire of perpetual adoration, right? So that was their whole life, was adoring our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament. A lot of people don't realize she spent 37 years in adoration of the Blessed Sacrament before EWTN was launched. She entered in 1944, August 15th, to begin a life of adoration. She carried that on. And then when she comes to Irondale, Alabama, again, it's adoration. And then the Lord eventually opens the doors to doing other things as well. But always adoration was at the heart of what she did. And it remains so. So when the sisters moved to the new monastery location, the employees have continued that life of adoration. It's always going to be the heart of EWTN. Oh,
that's beautiful. And obviously, we know.
That's right. Front and center.
Exactly. Always. Right. Father, thank you so much for traveling here and being with us.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. There are several exciting pilgrimage stops yet to come in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and California. If you would like to register for individual events, go to eucharisticpilgrimage.org and look for links for those local stops. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. The Supreme Court has determined the work of a Catholic charity is primarily religious. That major ruling tops the Week in Review. All nine justices agreed the state of Wisconsin violated the First Amendment when it denied a tax exemption to the Diocese of Superior's Catholic Charities Bureau. The Wisconsin-based ministry cares for people who are poor, elderly, and disabled. But because that charitable work does not attempt to convert those clients to the Catholic faith, both the state's Labor and Review Board and then its highest court determined it did not qualify for the tax exemption. In her majority opinion on Thursday, Justice Sonia Sotomayor called it textbook discrimination because the diocese's Catholic faith calls it to serve without making distinctions on sex, race, or religion. Mark Rienzi, whose team at Beckett represented Catholic Charities, called it a major victory for religious rights.
What the lower courts in the state of Wisconsin had done here was they said that the government gets to decide whether you're really religious or not. The idea of American governments doing that and picking and choosing who's the right kind of religion and who's the wrong kind of religion is a terrible idea and something that was very, very important for the Supreme Court to fix.
The Diocese of Superior's Bishop James Powers also celebrated the ruling and expressed his gratitude the Supreme Court is allowing his diocese to continue to serve those in need. This week, President Donald Trump escalated the trade war when he doubled current tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from 25% to 50%. He said the tariffs would end steel imports and counter foreign countries that continue to offload low-priced excess steel and aluminum in the U.S. market. Critics of the tariffs say they could raise prices for products from cars to appliances, as well as to construction materials and electrical equipment. Mexico's president says the tariffs have no legal basis because of a treaty signed by President Trump and his first administration that regulates trade between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada.
No creemos que sea...
We don't believe it is fair or sustainable because it makes everything more expensive, and we hope to reach an agreement. If we don't, we will be announcing measures that we must take to strengthen and protect jobs. This is not a matter of revenge or retaliation, as they say in English. No, it is a matter of protection.
The U.S. tariffs threaten 75% of Mexican steel exports valued at more than $2 billion and put key jobs and investments in Mexico at risk. This week, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, filled with President Trump's domestic policy agenda, moved to the GOP-controlled Senate. The signature tax and spending bill faces scrutiny from senators, several of whom are criticizing its price tag, saying it could grow the national debt by trillions of dollars and cut billions from safety net programs. Yet, some senators say there are not enough cuts, though the Senate version calls for an additional $150 billion for national defense. President Trump is pressing senators to get the bill passed and to his desk for signing by July 4th. In a new report released this week, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projected the One Big Beautiful Bill in its current form, as passed by the House, will strip nearly 11 million people of health insurance as Congress reshapes Medicaid. The findings also project the Trump's domestic policy agenda will add nearly $2.5 trillion to the deficit over the next decade and will not be offset by spending cuts or economic growth. The White House accuses the Congressional Budget Office of being partisan and political. In a dramatic shift from his previous calls for a ceasefire, President Trump suggested Ukraine and Russia should be left to sort out their war on their own. During a meeting with German Chancellor Friedrich Merz in the Oval Office on Thursday, Trump compared the two countries to little children and said it's better to let them fight it out before pulling them apart. He left the threat of sanctions on the table, but for both Russia and Ukraine. Russia slammed Ukraine with a barrage of missiles early Friday morning that targeted most of the country and killed at least four people. That airstrike was in retaliation for Kyiv's daring Operation Spiderweb, one of its largest counterattacks that took the Kremlin by surprise. The offensive targeted warplanes deep inside Russian territory. Ukraine's intelligence agency says its strikes caused billions in damages and hit more than a third of Russia's cruise missile carriers. Military analysts say the attack shows Ukraine can still bleed the Kremlin of its resources.
The future of warfare is the ability to do this kind of thing very, very deep. And I think what they've done is they're raising the cost for Putin. About 1 million Russians have been casualties already. They're raising the cost in strategic assets. And I think they're just trying to convince him at some point this is not worth the effort.
These attacks come as peace talks to end the war remain at an impasse. A second round of direct negotiations took place in Istanbul on Monday. Though no progress was made toward ending the war, the two sides agreed to exchange thousands of their dead and seriously wounded troops. This week, federal authorities arrested a suspect at New York's JFK Airport, whom they say is connected to last month's terrorist bombing of a Palm Springs, California fertility clinic. They accuse 32-year-old Daniel Park of providing explosive materials to 25-year-old Guy Bartkus, the primary suspect who detonated his car next to the clinic, killing himself, injuring several others, and causing extensive damage. Within days of the bombing, Park left for Poland, where he was detained by authorities in late May. The two young men reportedly connected over their belief that the existence of humans is unethical and plotted their attack for more than a year. Europe's most active volcano erupted on Monday, giving a spectacular display to onlooking tourists. Billowing towers of smoke and ash could be seen rising from Mount Etna, a popular vacation destination on the island of Sicily. Viral videos show tourists fleeing, but not before pausing to admire the scene. Despite its ominous appearance, authorities say the eruption posed no danger to the population. When we come back, it's on to Rome to celebrate a major jubilee.
In Rome, it is the jubilee of families, children, grandparents, and the elderly. And there are events happening right across the city. And we're going to go and check out just a few of them.
Reporter Colin Flynn shows us what it's like to attend a jubilee in the Eternal City. When we return, the jubilee that honors the bedrock of our society, the family.
The Jubilee Year 2025 is for everyone, both young and old. Last weekend, tens of thousands of pilgrims gathered in Rome for the Jubilee of families, children, grandparents, and the elderly, uniting generations to pray together and to reflect on their faith. Reporter Colin Flynn takes us to a full weekend of Jubilee events to show us up close what attending a Jubilee is like. This one, connected from young to old through the generations.
It's the Jubilee for families, children, grandparents, and the elderly. And there are events happening right across Rome. And we are going to go and check out just a few of them.
On the grounds of Castle Sant'Angelo, the castle of the Holy Angel, families had gathered to play. Katrina and her family are Italian, holding a little mascot of the Jubilee. They're excited to be in Rome for this event.
It's important because the Pope calls us to Rome to pray as a family.
We really wanted to see the new Pope too, which is what we did.
Emanuele Cita is one of the organizers of this event and tells me that it is to emphasize the role lay people can play in supporting each other in the faith.
Being together is better than, individualism, which is going on at the moment.
So we are testifying how, as lay people, as children, young and adult could be together in our society, developing, path for accompanying faith.
Under the summer sun, the children play with their parents, like Eduardo and his six-year-old son, Alexei.
Hello.
How are you?
How are you?
Come stai?
Sta bene.
Are you having fun?
Sì, mi diverto. Yes.
Grazie.
Welcome. Prego.
Prego.
Over at the auditorium of Palazzo San Callisto in Trastevere, a Jubilee conference was held to discuss the dark reality that so many children and families have to face in the world today. One of the speakers was Dr. Tanya Yahasan.
We have a duty to safeguard children, and that we're watching children be murdered, maimed, orphaned, and deprived of their futures in war zones throughout the world.
Dr. Hassan is a pediatric intensive care doctor working in Gaza and spoke about the horrors of what she has to witness every day. She was imploring the people there to do all they can to always safeguard children.
Late Pope Francis focused a lot on this and spoke about our duty to safeguard and protect children. And I think we have never been so visibly failing it.
Close by, in the Basilica of Santa Maria in Trastevere, the Santa Giudio community had arranged for Monsignor Vincenzo Paglia, President Emeritus of the Pontifical Academy for Life, to give a talk on the importance of the elderly in society.
I believe that the elderly are a very important part of our society. They are not a waste, but a resource.
You talked about the focus always on the young and older people wanting to be younger and spending all this money on cosmetics, but you said this is an illusion.
Absolutely.
Why?
It's an illusion because the elderly, they remind us that we are all fragile. No one is so autonomous that they don't need others. In the two extreme generations, young children and the elderly, this is evident, but also young people and adults need bonds, affection, support. This is why there is a teaching of fragility.
Ecco perché c'è un magistero della fragilità.
On Saturday night, midway through the Jubilee of Families, thousands of people gathered in front of the Archbasilica of St. John Lateran.
We just wanted to embrace our love for God, and we wanted to do it on a journey together because He has given us the privilege to be here.
Well, our desire was to be with the families in Rome for this Jubilee. It was a great desire, and I'm part of the religious family, but we all together in this pilgrimage are from different families.
And on Saturday night, thousands of families have gathered right here in front of the Basilica of St. John Lateran to celebrate their faith through music and song.
Various bands performed songs of worship, which were mixed with personal testimonies, and the crowd loved it, the young and the young at heart.
And you were telling me you are
87
years young.
Yeah.
Are you enjoying this evening?
Yeah, I am. Very much.
You like the music?
Yes.
The following morning, the sun was beating down on St. Peter's Square at the Vatican as people gathered to see Pope Leo XIV celebrate the special Mass for the Jubilee. In his homily, he told those gathered to be missionaries of the gospel who walk with other families.
It's our second time in Rome.
Wow.
First time it was for our honeymoon, and second time for this Jubilee with this baby. She wasn't there the first time, so we came here with her.
How life changes, eh?
Yeah, really.
The gift of life. And
the gift of God, and we are here to say thanks to God for this beautiful gift.
What's been the best part of the Jubilee so far?
Well, when we were up there, we saw the popes and we were with everyone, so I think that's been the best bit.
What was it like to see the Pope up close?
It was really good, and he was waving at us, and then he went off and our granny got a really good video of him.
And with that, the Jubilee for Families comes to an end here in Rome with the celebration of Mass here in St. Peter's Square with Pope Leo XIV.
In Rome, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
What a beautiful witness to the joy of family. But the excitement does not end there. The Vatican has many more jubilees planned throughout this summer, including the Jubilee of Sport next weekend. Three jubilees in a row for seminarians, bishops, and priests later this month. And in late July, thousands of young people will celebrate the Jubilee of Youth, which will include the highly anticipated canonization of Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati. And finally, if you are looking for a fun, lighthearted show to kick off your summer, EWTN has you covered. The award-winning hit EWTN web series James the Less is back for season two.
Maybe I'll go to confession.
But you're not Catholic.
Yet.
Are you becoming Catholic?
James the Less follows James Little, a fresh college graduate desperate for work. Though an atheist, he accepts a job as a handyman at a Catholic church. Little by little, he finds his secular ideals challenged as he encounters the Catholic faith. In this next season, you will meet other church members who help James on his faith journey and watch his budding romance with parishioner Anne Marie. The second season of James the Less will release on Monday, June 9th. This series is exclusively available online. You can watch new episodes and get caught up on season one on EWTN.com/James the Less. And that's this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until we see you again, God bless.